Thanks very much indeed for that introduction. That saves me having to do it myself. And it should be about a marketer's job to self-promote, I think. And you've heard a lot from the introduction there about retailing. Now, I think there's only actually one retail example in what I want to say this evening, because some of you may have been thinking, well, if this guy just knows about retailing, why am I here listening to him talking about small firm marketing? And it's particularly important that we distinguish between the kinds of marketing that certainly I kept my teeth on in working for Coca-Cola and for Tesco, which was the marketing undertaken by very large organizations, particularly consumer-facing organizations, and the kind of marketing that you might be involved in your own businesses, particularly business-to-business and business service firms, small science technology startups, the kinds of organizations that we see from the kinds of incubator activity that we have across the university. So although I will, I think, refer to certainly one, I think, retailer, what I want to talk about this evening is very much around the kinds of marketing challenges that face small and medium-sized enterprises and how they might be overcome. Now, one of my first, lessons is about clear communication. As someone commented from the back, I can't see that very well because it's turquoise on grey. Okay, so those of you that are a bit worried about that, the rest of the slides are actually reverse, so you'll be able to see them quite well, I hope, as we go through. Now, let me start by just reminding us, of course, that marketing can be a very persuasive activity, and I want to show you a couple of examples of that to kick us off.
Some people think the internet is a good thing. The most powerful educational tool the world has ever known. It's preserving our history, making sure that in the future we never forget the past. When disaster struck Asia, the volume of aid donated by ordinary people through websites outweighed that of their own governments. The internet is a place that is free of state regulation, censorship, and control. The only place where freedom of speech truly exists. Orwell was wrong. It is not the state that holds all the power. It is us. Some people think the internet is a good thing. What do you think?
So there's a classic piece of persuasive marketing. Are you persuaded that the internet is a good thing, or do you feel perhaps the reverse?
Some people think the internet is a bad thing. Somewhere your identity can be stolen, your home invaded, and your savings robbed without anyone setting foot inside your door. It is one of the most dangerous weapons ever created. A way for the unhinged to spread evil free of supervision or censorship. A place for mankind to exercise its darkest desires. An open market where you can purchase anything you want. Orwell was right. The internet has taken us to a place where everything we do is watched, monitored, and processed without us ever realizing it. Some people think the internet is a bad thing. What do you think?
So here we have the creative talents. You can imagine them sitting in the basement working out how to do this and create a good ad and a bad ad. But it shows you the creative talents of marketers and advertisers set to a purpose, to create a value proposition. And that value proposition in this case can either be the internet's a good thing or it's a bad thing. In this case, they're putting it side by side and asking you to decide. But actually, from my point of view, the creativity and the skill that's gone into that is largely irrelevant. What really matters is, does it work? Has it sold more AOL subscriptions? Some of the more eagle-eyed of you would have spotted that these were both ads for AOL. Anyone use AOL on a regular basis? Oh. Oh, dear. All right, we'll speak to you later about transferring your account. It has to be to an effect. Fantastic advertising, really compelling, really interesting. We could deconstruct that for hours to see how they did it with the music, the tone, the imagery, and so on. But did it work? Did it actually build market share for AOL? Well, actually, no. 1 billion losses in one quarter, the second quarter of the year this year. And The nice thing here is AOL Yahoo doesn't impress alone or together. You might have missed it, but the two 90s brands that keep sputtering along in spite of themselves made some big announcements last week. There's even talk of them possibly merging. Does anybody really care? So you know, all the good marketing in the world cannot help a duff value proposition. Okay? So if there's nothing at the heart of what you're trying to market to a customer base, then frankly it's not worth bothering. And that has to come first. So what do you want to do this evening? I want to start off with some basic questions. What are the kinds of things that as a startup, as a small business, you should be thinking about in terms of your marketing activity? What are the questions you should ask yourselves? I also want to think about what are the differences between marketing for companies like Coca-Cola and Tesco, companies I work with, and a small organization. What are the strengths that you can build upon within a small organization? Because there are a great many strengths that you can use to create an effective marketing strategy. And then we'll talk a bit about how to create and keep customers. And you'll see there it talks about value creation and co-creation, because one of the messages I want to put across this evening is that marketing, whether it's with large firms or small firms, but particularly with small firms, is about working hand in hand with your customers. Not waiting until you've got your product or service finally honed and ready to ship, but actually right at the very early stages of the design process, right at the stage where you're thinking about, well, what is the need? Where's the gap? What need am I fulfilling in creating this wonderful device or this wonderful service? So that co-creation comes in right at the very heart of that process. So creating customers is about, well, it's about getting known. It's about raising awareness, and small businesses have a hard time getting their heads above the parapet, actually standing out from the kind of white noise that surrounds us, particularly at the moment with, as we've seen, the growth of the internet. But then reaching those customers, working with them, and then keeping them. And keeping them is not just about selling them things every 6 months, but it's about creating and sustaining relationships. And we hear a lot of rhetoric, a lot of hype about relationship marketing. I want to debunk some of that this evening, but I also want to give you some practical steps about how you might seek to keep in touch with those people who think what you're doing is interesting, worthwhile, and worth paying for. And we'll talk a bit about that as well. And then we'll talk a bit about delivering service quality. So maintaining customer satisfaction, retaining loyalty of your customers over time, and delivering quality. And at the end, we'll perhaps share a bit of further reading and material that you can go and look at to build on your understanding. And that's AOL calling. I don't want to know. Thank you. Okay. So let's think about those basic questions. We hear a lot about a value proposition. I think you may have heard about some of that so far on this program. From a marketing point of view, a value proposition is not something that just sort of falls out of the tree and sort of lands in your lap. A value proposition is something you really have to work hard at creating and at defending and at arguing the case for. You know, who's it being created by? For whom? If it's being created for a certain group of customers, what are they going to value in it? How much are they going to pay for it? Where do they want to get it? How is that going to change over time? Because certainly if I think about something like this product, for example, you know, the value proposition is not necessarily about making phone calls. Okay? When this was first introduced, it was about saying, I've got this and you haven't. Okay? It was about a status goal. Okay? It wasn't about the fact that it could make phone calls. And indeed, the current version can't make very good phone calls even now, version 4 of this thing, if you hold your thumb in a particular place. But it's certainly, you know, about creating a kind of value. And that value changed over time. It changed from, you know, something which was about, I've got this and you haven't, to when I went home in the park and ride bus the other day, everyone had one of these. I'm saying, well, so why have I got this? Why am I paying more for this than, you know, I could be paying for any other device? Well, perhaps there are some good functional reasons why I use this. Perhaps it's the ease of use. Perhaps it's some of the design ethic, which is quite nice. So I'm now defending my purchase of this device rather than necessarily, you know, making it clear that there is a value proposition. But it can change over time. So what's now become the status symbol of choice in this particular brand category is that. You know? So you're sort of thinking about, well, how will this evolve over time? Because actually, we don't know what the value proposition is for this at the moment. When this is first introduced, everyone says it's a bit large for a phone. You know? And when Steve Jobs sort of came on with this like this, you know, he didn't do that with it, notice. But actually, they are, you know, going to fit this out with, I think the next version will have phone capabilities. So, you know, we've got to think about the way a value proposition will evolve. And actually, in this case, it's the customers who are helping that value proposition evolve. But how do we keep, for Apple, how do we keep these people buying this thing and not shifting to a cheaper alternative? How many of you have one of these? How many of you have a Kindle? How many of you want a Kindle for Christmas? How many of you are going to get one? Okay, right. So, you know, there are always cheaper alternatives. And as the ads will tell us, you know, the Kindle is the one when you're sitting next to the babe at the pool. That's the screen you can see, whereas the geek with the iPad is trying hard to see what's on the screen. So, you know, there are always competitive differences in relation to value propositions. So how are we going to retain our customers? And these questions apply to small firms as well as to large firms like Apple. The reverse of that is about capabilities, as far as marketing is concerned. You know, what experience, what capabilities do we have in marketing? Now, clearly, in a large organization, you're going to have a great many capabilities. In smaller, less so. Secondly, can we set aside our own personal biases and preferences? One of the things about marketing is, you know, you leave your values at the door, in a sense, because actually, if you don't, then you start trying to market things that you want rather than your target market. And thirdly, and most importantly, if we're spending money on things like Facebook pages or major Twitter campaigns or ads for AOL, you know, are we seeing a return on our investment in terms of the payback from our marketing spend? So those are basic questions that any organization should be asking about its marketing activities. Now, if you buy a textbook on marketing, and this is one of mine, sorry, you'll see a diagram like this. Okay? The diagram will talk about understanding value. It'll talk about designing, communicating value, or something similar. It'll talk about maintaining it, which is all about loyalty and profit at the end of the line. But actually, for a small organization, as you'll see from already looking at your handout, perhaps you weren't, no. You see it now. Actually, complex marketing theories may not be appropriate for small businesses. So you can throw away a lot of those textbooks, even mine, if you want to do that. No, don't throw away mine, actually. Hang on to that, because I can sign it at the end and have a much more valuable copy if you'd like to do that. But for small businesses, I think, in some senses, these are overcomplications. We should be asking some simple questions and taking some simple practical steps to creating and reaching and maintaining our customer connections. Let's think about marketing of small firms, because although marketing theories might not be critical to the success of small firms and to market decision-making, actually marketing insight and marketing knowledge is. So knowing about your customer base, having deep understanding of their needs, wants, desires, dreams, nightmares, preferences, dislikes, is going to be absolutely critical to getting your proposition right. The problem is that, of course, most small businesses don't have that kind of expertise, don't have that kind of resource, if you think about it in a formal marketing sense. Indeed, when you look at the research on SMEs and marketing, and there's quite a lot of it around, but there's probably more research on SMEs and marketing sometimes than there is actually the marketing resource within the firm itself. What you find is that the owner-managers who run many of these smaller enterprises are generalists, as we know. And actually, perhaps marketing is not one of the skills they may have picked up on. But often you find that for many SMEs, you'll find that the consideration is marketing is a non-problem. Anyone can do that. Anyone can sell. Or we'll get some of them to do it. We'll leave it to sales. And they equate sales and marketing, or they equate marketing with advertising. Actually, it's just advertising, isn't it? You know, it's the person on the top of the Clapham Omnibus who thinks that marketing is just advertising, nothing else, despite the fact that our political parties have demonstrated, you know, in the US and in Europe, that actually good marketing can achieve a great deal. It isn't just about advertising. It's about PR, personal presentation, lobbying, a whole range of activities that larger organizations get involved with. And for some also in SMEs, marketing can just mean the four P's, because I read that somewhere in a textbook. And if you don't remember the four P's, they are price, promotion, place, and what's the other one? Thank you. So everyone knows what the four P's are, although there are actually five or six, depending on which book you might want to read. I know seven P's is the usual kind of dinner party conversation of choice. So we have to get away from these sorts of attitudes about marketing, because actually, within SMEs, I would argue, there is a great deal of resource and expertise, and it's not recognized, it's not made explicit. The problem is, if you think about marketing in a conventional way, or think it's a non-problem, or it's sales, or it's advertising, and you don't prioritize it at the right stage in the development of your product or service, your marketing is going to be pretty unplanned, it's going to be spontaneous and haphazard. More importantly, though, it may be too late, because you've already made the mousetrap, and you're worrying why no one is beating a path to your door. So there are some challenges around how an entrepreneur, an SME, will acquire marketing capability. As I say, I think there are a number of things that SMEs have going for them that, in some respects, large organizations don't, because in some respects they've lost touch with some of those aspects. What can we characterize SMEs as having? Well, pretty good personal contact networks. It's the nature of entrepreneurship to be social, to be networking, to be in touch. And those networks are not just people looking to for funding, but they're networks for ideas, for potential customers, and potential sales. So the network is an ideal place to start, because they will know about your business. They will know about the market. We often hear discussion of the bandwidth of the market, which is basically the accumulation of all the networks operating in a marketplace and the relationships in that marketplace. But as a startup organization, as an SME, you're likely to have quite a tightly defined network of friends, investors, people who know about things that you're doing and can refer you, can recommend you, can talk about you to others using really very effective word of mouth. But that network can also help you guide your marketing decisions, and it can also help you with generating sales inquiries and contacts. So mine that network. Mine it relentlessly and remorselessly, because actually that's the place we can start in generating a customer base. But there are also some competencies within the business that are made up of the kinds of people that start new firms. What do we know about those people? We've heard over the last few weeks, the nature of entrepreneurship. But actually, people that create firms are themselves often imaginative, creative. They have vision. Actually, they have good selling skills, because otherwise, how would they have been able to command the kind of investment in their organization that they have been able to do to start the business up? So they have selling communication skills, and they have experiential knowledge. They have, in some cases, they may have tried and failed to start up new businesses. They may have gone through several iterations. Their experience of doing that process, and the experience of their network is absolutely critical, but is also there to be harnessed as a resource. So investing in those kinds of competences, recognizing them, making them explicit, is actually something that SMEs can do, I think, much more successfully than larger organizations. But in some senses, marketing is something that happens functionally, formally, institutionally. Whereas within smaller firms, it can happen informally. It can happen in a kind of social and networked manner, which is often far more effective at that stage in the development of a firm. So let's think about what a small firm might do. Anyone come across the Will It Blend service? Yes, well, let me just see if we can get this going and give you again a demo of this. This is a great little organization that started actually about 35 years ago. It's called the Blend Tech Corporation. It's a guy called Tom Dixon, who was a startup back in 1975, and he had a newly patented micronizing grain mill. Okay, but the actual mechanism he used for creating the blade and the chopping and blending motion saw its best application in terms of a domestic household blender. So how does he communicate? Well, he's still going strong. He's the chairman of the company, founder of the company.
Will it blend?
And this is
that is the question. I love my new iPad. It does a ton of cool things. But Will it blend? That is the question. Doesn't quite fit in the jar, but I can take care of that. I knew I could get the iPad in a BlendTec Total Blender. I think I'll press the iBlend button. Smoke. Don't breathe this. Ah, that was one tough pad.
Okay, so, well, he also has a website there if you want to see more. I mean, you know, that stands out. First of all, he's the CEO. He's personally promoting his product. Those of you with iPads, even, you can uncross your legs now. It's safe to look again. He has got rid of it. But again, what's he seeking to demonstrate? The point of difference, his value proposition. This thing will blend anything, okay? And he's put his personal commitment behind that. And this is, again, you know, this is a firm that is 35 years old, but actually he is using contemporary communications media. This is actually on a YouTube channel. You can subscribe to it and get the latest things that he's blending. But it taps into his own creativity, okay? His own skill at selling, his persuasive abilities. So never to be said, you know, that those skills don't exist in a small business, because almost by definition, the creative skill does and can be harnessed to good effect. So let's think about, a bit about this creating customers piece of the equation. And here's where a piece of theory does come in handy. One of the ways in which marketing is changing, at least academically, is moving from what was called sort of goods-dominant logic. In other words, you made stuff, then you sold it. And actually, you told consumers what to buy. Even though you might have understood what their needs were, you know, there wasn't much kind of communication or consultation between buyer and seller. So the producer was experienced, knowledgeable, as it says there, innovative, creative. The consumer was anything but passive, dull, a recipient of product or service. And you know, as you saw with the iPad there, you know, value was destroyed in the consuming of a product. That's moving now to what's called a service-dominant logic, which effectively means that the value is not created by a firm and then passed on to the customer, but is co-created. And that kind of phrase, co-creation, is something which is now preoccupying many marketers. But actually, it makes sense when we think particularly about small businesses. It's harder to think about, I don't know, Lloyds Bank or you know, Tesco co-creating value with its consumers. You know, there are millions of them. How do they do that? But you can see it for a small organization working creatively, integrating resources and ideas and experiences with a small group of potential customers to actually refine and adapt an idea. And indeed, many of the larger organizations that try to do this have had to do it using technology. So here's the Starbucks site, mystarbucksidea.com, which, when I took this screen capture, had generated 22,500 coffee and espresso drink ideas. Now, okay, a wedding line of coffee mugs and a Starbucks in Herning, Denmark may not be particularly innovative, but, you know, they're interesting ideas. And if only one or two of those out of 1,000 turns out to be an effective way in which Starbucks can increase its market share, can re-engage with its customer base, then it's been worth that effort of engagement. The issue is, how far is this kind of rhetoric, again, hype, and how far are these kinds of ideas really acted upon? You know, we can see a whole variety of them to do with coffee and espresso drinks. I very doubt whether 22,000 ideas could be, you know, actively worked with within the organization. It's a bit like the UK government seeking ideas for cuts in bureaucracy. I think they had 30,000 suggestions and they implemented 4 of those, okay? Because most of them were unprintable, I think. So, but the principle was there, though. It was actually working with the consumer to try and refine, develop, harmonize the need and the value proposition. And certainly if we look at the theoretical models around this for things like service industries, we find everyone talks about co-creating value. They talk about immersing yourselves in customers. And most of the textbooks along this line will talk about, you know, getting down and dirty with your customers. Creating all kinds of mechanisms, ranging from, you know, observation of how they behave, what they do, right the way through to developing scenarios with them, segmenting them, which sounds rather damaging, getting involved with what's called means-end chain analysis, for example, which is trying to understand what their fundamental reasons for behaving as they do actually are. So a whole series of steps that you can take to actually try and create that sort of value. But do they care? Do you, for example, want to work with Tesco to create the next generation of superstore? I rather suspect not. Okay. So another issue around creating customers and working with customers is, do they want to work with you? So are your customers sufficiently interested in what you're trying to do to work with you to make a better product or service? And this is around involvement, and we can think of this in consumer market terms. We can think about, for example, what might encourage customers to want to work with us. Well, for example, if something is very expensive, if they only buy it relatively infrequently, if it has high symbolic meaning. So something like an iPad, which is still intact, thank goodness, has sort of high symbolic meaning, has high social visibility at the moment. Clearly, you know, there's a lot of interest in trying to work together to create a better product in order to meet those sorts of objectives. But actually, if your product is cheap, it's frequently purchased, it's pretty incidental, it doesn't take much time to consume, like a soft drink, it's not very socially visible, it's toothpaste. I mean, you don't know what brand of toothpaste I've used this morning on my teeth. You don't really care as long as my breath smells fresh and we talk over drinks afterwards, you know. So thinking about social visibility is an indication of the level of involvement. So we can start to think about co-creation, but really only if our customers care enough about what we're doing to want to work with us. And the challenge is to help them achieve that. So one of the ways of trying to find out whether our customers care is, well, asking them. And there are a variety of mechanisms. Some of the examples I've chosen this evening are drawn directly from university startups and certainly university-related activities. And here's my first example, which is Galaxy Zoo. Anyone use Galaxy Zoo? Two, three, four. It's a crowdsourcing application. You've come across these. These are quite nice examples of trying to crunch through a problem using the mass power of linked computers and networks and individuals. And this is about crowdsourcing classifications of galactic objects. It's about as far from the iPad, I suppose, as you can get, although there's a pretty neat app for that on the iPad. It was launched about 4 years ago. They were trying initially to differentiate between elliptical and spiral galaxies. But the important point to put across here is actually about awareness raising. Because this process of actually gathering people who are interested in doing this sort of stuff, who want to spend their evening not watching X Factor, but classifying galaxies, and I know which I'd rather be doing, frankly, given where Wagner is at the moment. I think, you know, we have a very good way of identifying potentially interesting prospects. Now, 250,000 collaborators working now in Galaxy Zoo, which actually is bigger than Oxford, 158,000 people in Oxford, bigger than the British Army, and my favorite example is more than the number of Quakers in North and South America combined, okay, now collaborating in this Galaxy Zoo project. And the awareness that has been generated for this, even though only four people here are using it, never mind, is quite substantial internationally as well as within the UK. So again, there are now technological mechanisms for gathering intelligence about people who might be interested in what you're doing. Here's another example, a more, I suppose, more relevant example for those of you that are interested in scholarship and research. This is a startup from a marketing PhD student, a couple of other guys, one from medicine, I think, who have started up a small organization which is around a research management tool for scholars. So often these days, we're doing collaborative research between departments of the university, between different universities, keeping each other in touch internationally, particularly with papers that you've come across, with interesting ideas, and your annotations and views on those papers is quite difficult. You can't send the PDF because it's of the copyright issues and so on. Mendeley.com is an organization set up to to establish an online research network. So you can create collaborative networks online, share your research findings, or your research literature with others. And the interesting thing here is actually this has taken off, again, exponentially through word of mouth. So creating awareness, this particular service now has gone in the last, well, the last 2 or 3 years from just being a sort of a specialist bespoke interest of a few PhD students to being something now that's being lectured on by academics and universities trying to cut costs and encourage people to use these kinds of free-to-air services rather than actually buying the expensive database aggregation services. But the point I want to mention on this particular example is not so much the awareness raising, but the way in which Mendeley has creatively sought to reach out to its customer base. So every university campus, for example, has a series of brand ambassadors that will market the Mendeley service on behalf of the business, as well as the usual Twitter and Facebook activity and sort of peer reviews. There's a kind of spread the word service, so incentives to spread the word about the activity, and also the opportunity to become an advisor. And this is critical. Becoming an advisor means that you can help play a part in the way in which the Mendeley service develops. You can help prioritize particular features and push down others that are less important. So there's a kind of creative evolution going on here with some of the leading super users, if you like, of Mendeley, who are helping to create a more usable, useful, and durable, and frankly, competitively defensible product, because the customers are working with Mendeley to create a mutually useful value proposition between them, which is this research network. And already, Mendeley is in the top 10 of the Guardian Top Tech 100 companies. The CTO of Amazon.com says he strongly believes that Mendeley can change the face of science. Certainly, it can help improve personal and research productivity, absolutely. So that's the value proposition. If you know any researchers, if you are that researcher that has a room full of printout or that has a laptop which has whole hard disks full of undifferentiated research papers, then Mendeley is the service for you. And I'm not even an advisor, so I can highly recommend it to you. So creating customers is about using those networks. It's about using innovative ways of reaching out to interested parties, working with them to create the product at an early stage. Let's think a little bit about keeping those customers, because it's all very well getting excited, raising their awareness, raising their expectations. How do we think about keeping that customer? Well, in many ways, the keeping of customers for a small organization is very similar to that for many larger organizations. You have some choices. Are you the kind of organization that's simply into transactional exchanges, this left-hand side? Are you just selling stuff to people? You know, there's no one else in the marketplace, so for example, you know, the availability of alternatives is pretty many, then actually you can end up simply being an anonymous transactor of product along with everybody else. But actually, if there are relatively few alternatives, people will beat a path to your door. People want collaborative exchanges. People want to continue to work with you in refining the product, as Mendeley is seeing, but perhaps will also, you know, want to recommend you to their friends and will also want to perhaps get you to produce bespoke things for them, particularly if you're in a business-to-business activity. So thinking about whether you're at the transactional end of the spectrum or at the collaborative end of the spectrum is a choice that you need to think about. The other factors that are going to be important is, well, again, how important is the purchase for the buyer? How complex is the purchase? If the purchase is very complex, then actually the buyer is going to want to be quite close to you, want to work with you to understand the full implications of what they're buying. Perhaps there are complex after-sales services and add-ons that you'll want to produce that will make that collaboration quite important to the buyer. Perhaps there's a lot of scope for information exchange. Perhaps, you know, it isn't just about buying it, walking away, and using it. Perhaps there are many things that the buyer will have to talk to you about afterwards. So if you can invent or create those kinds of things, then you have a way of maintaining that relationship. But I think the word relationship has been overused. Frankly, for many large organizations, there is a deliberate attempt to try and disrupt cozy relationships between buyers and sellers, because you get into very dangerous territory once you start to get a bit too cozy between buyers and sellers. And so what you find is a decision-making unit, a larger firm, is actually quite formal. It may even be a procurement committee that is considering your product or service. And then the people to actually have the relationship with is not so much the initiators or the deciders, but actually the gatekeepers, those people who control the flow of access to the firm that you're trying to supply to. And often that's the buyer or the secretary or the PA or the person that actually signs you in at the front desk who happens to know the phone number of the person you want to reach. So appropriate relationships, you know, may be quite important in dealing with formal buying structures. But I think the relationship metaphor itself has been considerably overused. Again, you know, do you really want a relationship with your supermarket, as a loyalty card and so on might imply that you do? As a small firm, though, I think the relationship you have with your immediate network is very, very important. When you get large, only very few companies really have, I think, reached the kind of nirvana of having a kind of a genuine relationship with some of their customers. I think of operations like Harley-Davidson, for example. The Body Shop had this, Southwest Airlines in the States. We have loyal and, you know, regular recommenders of what they do. Actually, frankly, most of us deal with organizations on a kind of transactional or loose relationship basis. You know, we don't think about Tesco in the same way we think about our partner at home or our boyfriend or girlfriend. Thank goodness, some of us might think. So thinking about some of these the ways in which academics think about relationship marketing, the marriage model, they talk about the life cycle. You know, you go through establishing this relationship, you court, you go out for a while, you know, you procreate, you have children, products, you know. These kind of analogies are all rather dodgy, frankly, when it comes to thinking about how, again, particularly small firms may need to work in this kind of area. So relationships can be quite a dangerous analogy to use, or a dangerous metaphor to use. We also hear a lot of talk about brand communities. I think brand communities are quite interesting in this area because what a brand community is in effect, a stable relationship between an organization and its admirers. And just like any other community, we know who the other admirers are of that brand. So, for example, you know, again, who's got an iPad? Yeah, okay, so yeah, well, we're one of a kind, us, iPad owners, okay? So there's a consciousness of kind. We go through rites and rituals, so we'll do an exchange of apps later over drinks, okay? Have you seen this really great one? You know? There's a moral responsibility, so if I, you know, drop my iPad on the floor, you know, every iPad owner will groan, but many of them will rush to my aid, okay? In fact, you may laugh, but actually the research shows that for car ownership, for example, you're more likely to stop for the person that is driving a car like yours than you are for any other person. Despite the fact that they may be an axe murderer, okay? You'll stop for them because they're driving the same color Saab as you. And so they must be like you, and, you know, you wouldn't want to be left in that kind of situation, would you? So a brand community is very much around, you know, moral responsibility, an obligation to each other. Now, you know, again, within a small organization, building that kind of close community, a small number of buyers who are mutually interdependent, who understand the values and motives of the organization, that trust the organization, is really, really critical to retaining the customer base. And in some senses, a brand community is actually a very effective way of trying to do that. They're hard to create, though. Here's an example of one. Anyone use Wolfram Alpha? Ah, more hands this time. Very good. So some mathematicians in the room, which is excellent. Now, Wolfram Alpha, as you may know, those of you that put your hands up at least, you know, was actually, in effect, a specialized search engine. In fact, so specialized, you needed training to work out how to ask the question, let alone understand the answer. Okay? But here's a great example of a brand community, a small business as it started up. So Mathematica, which Wolfram Research founded, you know, several years ago, you know, over 20 years ago now, generated an established user base as a mathematical programming language. And it was that user base that Wolfram used to piggyback on to launch Wolfram Alpha. And working with those customers to understand their needs and indeed, you know, to give themselves a kickstart in terms of both creating and then retaining Mathematica users. So the kinds of quotes here, you know, could be as important as Google, but making all systematic knowledge immediately computable and accessible to everyone, or rather, while it's accessible to my 14-year-old son, I find it rather harder to get beyond Wolfram Alpha's interface, I must admit. But, you know, this is certainly a great example of a small firm which is keeping its customer base on side in the kind of work it's doing through its conferences, through its seminars and activities, through its outreach, and through the ways in which it works with its users to continually evolve its products and services. How do you keep in touch in retaining your customer base? Well, when you ask many firms, you know, what kinds of communications channels are becoming more or less effective, this is what you come up with. This is a survey in the US a couple of years ago, and it's ranking communications channels by the most at the top to the least at the bottom in terms of increasing effectiveness. And it's quite interesting to see that, you know, declining effectiveness, we see newspapers, yellow pages, telemarketing, so getting your friends to hit the phones to summon up sales may no longer be as effective a strategy as we thought it was. Far more effective, according to respondents, are social media, search engine marketing, mobile channels, online video, games. Anyone bought that new game? What's it called? Thank you. Very good. Who's got that new game? Well, a few hands. The audience isn't quite right for it. If you have an audience of 15-year-olds, every hand would shoot up, okay? But, you know, game marketing, using gaming as a marketing channel is a really interesting way at the moment of promoting products and services. But, you know, keeping in touch with your customer base increasingly requires skills and capabilities, not just in traditional channels, but in, of course, newer channels too. And, you know, the examples I've given you, like Galaxy Zoo and Mendeley, could not exist were it not for the internet and for social media. But let's just take a look at companies say this, but what do customers say? How much do you trust what you hear through various kinds of channels? And actually, well, email, sure, I trust it, but only from people I know, 3/4. That's the top ranking sort of information source. Customer products, ratings and reviews, portals and search engines, yellow pages, not online. So actually, even though on the one hand companies say yellow pages are declining in effectiveness, they're still the number 4 in terms of people's sort of willingness to search out information. So again, you have to be a bit careful in interpreting some of the findings from this kind of research, because it might be quite what people want to think the researchers want to hear. Of course, social media. Yes, absolutely. We're all going to be investing in Twitter and Facebook over the next few years. Of course we are. We don't know what for, but we're going to be doing it. We're actually, in fact, you know, perhaps some selected magazine promotions could be an effective way of keeping in touch. So think carefully about choosing the right kinds of promotional media, the most cost-effective promotional media, to meet the objectives and the characteristics of your customer base. Let's think of 2 or 3 examples. So email, first of all. Sure, there are great advantages of email. It's fantastically cheap, i.e. free in many cases, because it's subsumed almost within your ISP cost. It's a tremendously effective campaign tool. So if you're into selling or promoting lots of things, lots of people, you know very quickly how effective your promotional mechanism has been. If you're offering a 3-for-1 or a 4-for-1 price offer, you know, you know very almost instantly how effective that is. And it's a push tool. So you're not waiting for customers to ask you for stuff, you're pushing it out to them. But as I've suggested, perhaps, you know, push marketing may not be as effective as the kind of collaborative or consensual marketing, permissive marketing, that we often hear talked about today. So we can see lots of advantages of email campaigns and trackability. But when we look at how consumers think about email, they're only really interested in getting email from people that they trust, that they know. Increasingly, of course, we have lots of mechanisms now for cutting out a lot of this information overload. You know, a lot of filters, either manual or automatic, to cut out spam, to cut out commercial messaging. So getting and retaining contact with your customers is about ensuring that you are trusted by them enough to be on their white list of incoming email. And what that also starts to suggest is that email marketing may be changing in terms of its level of impact. Well, I think it absolutely certainly is. This data suggests that. That actually those people that think that the impact of email is actually increasing a lot has fallen over the last 2 or 3 years. So the impression is that actually we're not getting, perhaps even though it's free, as much of an impact as we would like to with that current technology. Or we can engage in this. There'll be a test later. This is a quite interesting visualization. There's a great little startup company called Vaughan's One Page Summaries. Highly recommend this little organization. He's he's an ex-MBA, he's now selling his ability to synthesize onto one page complex stuff. Okay? So this is how search engine optimization works. Okay? Now, I think you might have to get his consulting services for him to interpret this. And I'm sure that's part of the value-added proposition for this particular business. But this particular one-page summary, first of all, says how complex search engine optimization is, but it also says a little bit about, you know, how it works in terms of the nature of the rankings of terms and where the money is made by Google and by others in this kind of activity. So certainly if you're a company that is seeking to attract and retain customers through search engine optimization, perhaps you've got a product that really is the kind of thing that people will really search for, because they only want something like this once in a blue moon. Take mole traps. How many of you have bought a mole trap recently? Anyone? Nobody. Well, actually, I have. Sorry. Okay. So we have an allotment, and we have exhausted all possible humane routes to mole disposal. Okay. So my wife instructed me to go out and find some mole traps. What do? I Google mole traps. What do I find? Search engine optimization gives me moletraps.co.uk. And there it is. This is one guy, a traditional mole catcher based in Sussex. Okay? He spent his life catching moles, designing traps with gamekeepers to catch and dispatch moles humanely. Although you might be forgiven for thinking not quite so humane when you see some of the images there. But here is, again, a single bloke who has gone around using new technology to reach and retain customers. So I've been talking about this guy to my neighbours who are equally troubled with moles for the last 6 months. His profits must be going through the roof. Okay? But he has managed to retain the customer base not through email, although he does have an email subscription service, but actually simply through intelligent use of the search engine optimization technology. And if I look at this now, there is now a competitor. Okay? Mole traps online. Okay, so here we have a mole, in case you hadn't seen one before. But you see the trap there. Oh, it's not very nice. So if you're looking for a nice soothing image of how to buy a mole, there's the problem, you see. So that's the problem that you're trying to solve. Whereas mole traps online, well, you know, they're just talking about the nasty metal trap that you have to buy. So search engine optimization for certain kinds of products and services can be a very effective way of communicating and keeping in touch with your customer base. But frankly, far more effective, I think, is, again, particularly for smaller organizations, word of mouth, and particularly electronic word of mouth. Keeping in touch either through talking to prospective customers, talking to your friends, through recommendation, or through some kind of sponsored activity, some kind of forum. And there's been a substantial growth in third-party fora of people who are interested in certain kinds of things. So the Galaxy Zoo, for example, has a forum. A number of these kinds, Mendeley has a forum for its users. It's a way of keeping in touch with developments. It's a way for users to talk to other users and to keep themselves excited and enthused about your products and services. Now, some of these are quite spontaneous. Some of them are actually sponsored or hosted by third parties who are seen as being neutral and objective. The less successful ones can sometimes be sort of corporate sponsored. A bit like brand communities, you know, if you look at them too carefully, they go away. They always have to be spontaneous and from the grassroots and from your users rather than sort of imposed and created by you as the firm. And, of course, social media. And all I want to say about social media at this point, it really is to say, look, be very, very careful that you're clear, again, what are your objectives for using social media? Do your customers or potential customers use social media? Which ones do they use? What role does your Facebook page or your YouTube channel or your Twitter channel play in the buying decision-making process of your ideal customer. So don't just jump on the bandwagon. Don't just launch a fan page or a Twitter feed. I was just, for the fun of it, clearly I have nothing better to do with my time, spending some time assembling a list of rather redundant Twitter feeds by companies. And there's one by a company called ElectroSpares, okay, which tweets every time it has a new solution to a plumbing problem. Okay. Now, I really didn't want to know that. You know. In fact, my most useful Twitter feed is actually now Eurostar, because Eurostar tweets very, very often and successfully now. It didn't last Christmas when things went badly wrong. But it now tweets a lot about the reliability of trains under the channel. And my second most useful Twitter feed is actually the people who complain about First Great Western. If you search for #FGW on Twitter, you will find that there is a word-of-mouth community who basically are united in their hatred and despise of First Great Western as a service. And you can read some cracking anecdotes in 149 characters, or 150 characters, of their commuting experiences. If I was First Great Western, I'd be monitoring that to understand how my consumers felt about my brand. I'm not sure they do. Or if they do, they don't do much about it. So social media is clearly around a variety of objectives. It's about certainly that intelligence, keeping in touch with what your user base is thinking. Because almost certainly there are people tweeting in this room now who are saying he's gone on too long, it's 2 minutes to go, and he's still talking, he hasn't said much about the last bit he wanted to talk about, and so on. So there is always this back chatter going on of Twitter that we need to be aware of. But again, these kinds of channels are largely free-to-air. How do we use them effectively is going to be a consideration for, particularly for small firms who see this as a potential mechanism to reach the marketplace. If you don't, your customers may do. So here's a great example in Japan, actually. This is 25,000 Japanese consumers have nothing better to do with their time than to tell each other about where the best deals are in the regional supermarkets. Okay? And they're driving these firms out of business. So they are simply sharing all this discount information and sabotaging, as it says there, efforts to save Japan's economy from stagnation. This is a bit like the time when Japanese consumers were collecting telephone cards with charged money on them, and at one point had something like 5% of GDP wrapped up in collected telephone cards. So this is the same kind of phenomenon. It's actually this kind of crowdsourcing of intelligence, consumer-to-consumer intelligence. So what's this got to do with, ultimately, small businesses keeping customers? Well, it comes down in the end to sustaining customer satisfaction and customer loyalty. Satisfaction is a dangerous word, as is loyalty, frankly, because actually many customers will often tell you what they think you want to hear rather than what you ought to know about how they're doing how you're doing in terms of your provision of products and services. So thinking about how you gather satisfaction data is quite important. Similarly, thinking about how you move from satisfaction to loyalty. What kind of loyalty are you looking for? Are you looking simply for price loyalty? Well, we're cheapest this week. Or are you looking for that real emotional loyalty that might lead to a lifetime relationship with a customer? That will determine the way in which you seek to cultivate and retain your customer base. Now, if you're a service organization, then similar things will apply, but actually, the way in which you will want to move from simply ensuring good quality services to ensuring innovation in services is something that you're going to want to have to think about. And the challenge here is really about service quality, because when you're consuming a service, and let me give you an example of a classic service that is not Will It Blend, but actually is. Here's one started up by a former engineering and management student here, Caroline Plum, and her colleague Charlie Osmond. Caroline recently went with David Cameron on the business investment trip to India, so hasn't she done well? Is also on the advisory board for the business school. But she started as a small organization with fresh minds, which started off using the talent of university students to do cheap consulting for companies, undercutting Deloitte's, McKinsey, Bain, and maybe even doing a better job, who knows. This kind of organization was very much about generating, first of all, reliable quality research. It was about also word of mouth, So people who got good work from this team told their friends, told their colleagues in other organizations, they in turn recruited. It span off into Fresh Minds talent. So sure, these students wanted to do some research work, but they also wanted a job at the end of it. So it was a talent division of the organization. And then into independent research, as well as simply the thinking activity. So Fresh Minds as a business has retained its customer base by keeping customers satisfied in terms of the quality of the service that they have been experiencing. And if we go back to this diagram, ensuring that expected quality, as to say what you would expect of a high-quality consulting service, is actually exceeded by experienced quality, which means that your perception is actually, wow, that was a really great experience I had. A lot of that is through word of mouth, it's through effective marketing communication, and it's through past experience services. Let me finish with a couple of practical examples of organizations. I said there's one retail example. Here's a retail example that started very small. And again, let's see if we can draw together all the lessons of the things I've talked about this evening about building customer awareness, about reaching and retaining customers, about ensuring service quality in what you're delivering. This is Zappos, probably one of the most exciting shoe shops online ever to hit the airwaves. It's the most extraordinary business. And in fact, Amazon sought to bottle the customer service mentality and organizational culture of Zappos by buying the business. But just before it bought it, it was worth about $1 billion in terms of sales. So started very small. The founder started really just selling a small number of shoe ranges online. Grew into this phenomenal business, which is not really about selling shoes, but it's really about good customer service. So the value proposition is about, in effect, the kind of quality customer service that you simply didn't get from regular shoe shops. But for some reason, you could get online, which seems quite a paradoxical thing. And that's because Zappos is as much a culture. The way they recruit their talent, the way they deal with the customer base. They get 5,000 calls a day, 1,200 emails a day. They deal with those on the spot. An email is responded to within half an hour. The loyalty team works around the clock. They are quite amazing sorts of individuals. They recruit for weirdness, I think, actually. Certainly not your conventional kind of call center employee. But very much, and there's a link to a YouTube video if you want to see them in action, very much a value proposition which is built around retaining customers through word-of-mouth effects. So everyone raves about their Zappos experience because they not only meet expectations, but they exceed quality expectations in terms of customer service. So it does more than it says on the tin. And all the time, they're proving they go beyond what customers would expect from a conventional shoe retailer. My final example is a local firm, though, and that's Alamy.com. So I think in Alamy, you've got all these things coming together. You've got, first of all, an Oxford startup, which I think is a really great idea. Founded in Oxfordshire around about 10 years ago, now worth around 17 million, so relatively modest in terms of revenue over that period of time. But the business they've got almost sets a seal on co-creation of value. Because what they're about is a stock photography site. It's not like some of the big ones that you see. This is actually one that is there as much for the benefit of the members, if you like, because they're almost members rather than customers, than you know, for some kind of vast commercial profit to be gained by gouging customers, as some of the very large houses might be alleged to be doing. And the way in which they work is very much around keeping customers through fairness and trust. They have very flexible contracts compared to many of the larger organizations that have very fixed and often quite exploitative contracts. They have much higher royalties. They work with customers in thinking about new ways of bringing new services and products to bear. So here's an example of that, which is a Find a Photographer service, which is a kind of Google map mashup of where to find an amateur photographer if you want some snaps done of your wedding. Collaboratively ranking the quality and the interest of particular photographs through Alamy Rank, using their customers to source review and recommendation information, which is a now more conventional kind of approach. But then also this obsessive customer service, which is really about fairness and around trust. So those values of the organization have been translated into a value proposition, which is then communicated to customers. And they're not really customers, because some of the customers are also suppliers. So you've got suppliers supplying photographs, you've got suppliers who are also customers, and you've got customers who are being dealt with fairly and can see that they're making a contribution to the success of amateur photography within the UK. And as a result, we've got 20 million images, 21,000 photographers, a fantastic network, in this case, a resource for that SME to use, to mine, for new ideas, for recommendation, for cross-selling opportunities, you know, word-of-mouth effects. Where else could you find, you know, 21,000 enthusiastic individuals who will go out and market your business on your behalf? So I come back to my final point, which is really around networks, around exploiting the networks that you have, making them work for you, extending them, cultivating them, using some of the more cost-effective mechanisms to keep in touch with those networks. And that's a way in which I think small and medium-sized businesses can be successful in their creating and cultivating of customers. And there are a few final points about being good at marketing. And I wanted to finish my final minute just with some further reading. These you've got in the handout, just a couple of books that you might want to look at. In particular, if you're interested in using the internet for marketing, then Dave Chaffee's book is extremely worthwhile to look at in terms of practical strategies. And those of you interested in professional service activities, business services, Laurie Young. And those of you who look at international markets, the text there, International Marketing, is probably one of the best designed around the needs of small firms. But actually, a lot of this stuff's electronic. So I'd recommend highly a great blog by a guy called James Jantz on, it's called Duct Tape Marketing, which speaks for itself. It's about, you know, make and mend marketing in some senses on a small budget. Some great ideas in there. And then if you're interested in slightly higher tech or social marketing, then Mashable Business is worth looking at. And then Dave Chaffee's own website, where he brings together a range of digital marketing experts, again free to air, is Smart Insights. So there are three really useful electronic resources that you can use. So I'm going to stop the formal session there. I think we have time for questions now or after? How we do? Right, so we'll adjourn now for, I think, a drink, and very happy to talk to anyone that would like to ask some questions at that point. But thank you for your patience and your interest this evening. Thank you.